There was a second Chechen war, and between those wars and during them as well, there were massive terrorist attacks in the region of Northern Caucasus and also in like, you know, central cities of Russia. Some investigators say that those attacks have been performed by FSB actually to blame it on terrorists from Northern Caucasus. But unfortunately, right now, we don't have any evidence to say if it was one or the other. And it was used, I think that Putin's regime and Yeltsin regime, they negotiated some kind of deal with Ahmad Kadyrov, with the father of Ramzan, saying that you will have complete power over this region. If you stop fighting for freedom, he will give you whatever you want. And then you can just, like, you will be the king of this land. And that's what have happened. And his father was killed by the terrorist attack in Grozny on the stadium many years ago, and then the authorities came to Ramzan, who was quite young at the moment, and now he basically rules a very, very harsh dictatorship in the region. Memorial always said that whatever is happening in Chechnya, it does not get any investigation or any proper response from the authorities. And thus, this wave of impunity was growing first in Russia. And then, as we can see, it started also falling on Ukraine, on other countries. And unfortunately, it demonstrates to us again, once we ignore human rights violations that are happening inside the dictatorship like Russia, it will always, always, always end up in a massive, horrible massacres outside its borders.
Anna Dubrovskaya, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Served as executive director of Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow before it was shut down by the Russian government last year. Next up, we go to Syria, where the United Nations has established an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the 12-year conflict. And we'll look at a new BBC documentary, Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. Then Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us from South Carolina. Stay with us.
پیاله را که شب می گذارد پیشار پیاله را که شب می گذارد می نوش می نوش می نوش می نوش که عمر جان
Caravan of Life by Massa Fatah. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to Syria. Humanitarian groups Wednesday urged the United Nations Security Council to extend Syria's cross-border aid mechanism for another year in order to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid to more than 4 million people in northwest Syria after 12 years of war. The mechanism was established in 2014 to enable the UN and other humanitarian groups to provide aid to opposition-held areas in Syria without the authorization of the Syrian government. Doctors Without Borders reports the number of authorized crossing points is now down from 4 to 1, even after an earthquake devastated parts of Syria in February, and the need is enormous. Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly has approved a resolution to establish an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the conflict in Syria and to, quote, provide adequate support to victims, survivors, and the families of those missing. The Syrian government opposed the resolution along with Russia, China, Belarus, North Korea, Cuba, and Iran. This comes as ITV News reports that in the days leading up to the failed mutiny by Wagner Group in Russia, Syrian officials were in talks to increase the number of Wagner fighters in Syria and make Syria its biggest base as part of a lucrative deal with President Bashar al-Assad. In a minute, we're going to look at a new BBC documentary investigating Assad's role in producing the highly addictive amphetamine known as Captagon and how this is impacting his relations with Saudi Arabia and other countries. But we begin with Dr. Zahar Salul, president and CEO of the medical nonprofit Med Global, which provides health care in disaster regions, including Syria. He was also a classmate of Bashar al-Assad in medical school. Yes, the president of Syria is also a doctor. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Dr. Zahar Salul. Start off with talking about the 120,000 people it's estimated are missing in the 12 years of this conflict, doctor.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. And this is one of the most painful chapters in the Syrian crisis. As you mentioned, 120,000 people are at least missing in the last 12 years, most of them according to human rights organizations by the Assad regime, about 85% of them. One of them is a dentist and also the chess champion in Syria. Her name is Dr. Rania Abbasi, who disappeared in 2013 by the Assad regime intelligence in the prison with her six children. One of them was 1.5, one year and a half, and the oldest was 13 years old. She still disappeared, and no one knows where she. But she's one of tens of thousands of women and children and men who disappeared by the Assad regime, and their families do not know any information about them. Some of the family members got to know that their loved ones have died under torture by looking at the pictures of the Caesar files, which, as you remember, this is a person who smuggled about 30,000 pictures of people who died under torture by the Assad regime, and some family members discovered that their loved ones died because of torture. So hopefully this will allow the families of the loved ones who their loved ones, sons, children, sisters, and fathers have disappeared, to have one source of information about their family members, and hopefully have a closure for this painful chapter.
Dr. Salul, how is this mechanism, this institution likely to work? What tools will people have to find these disappeared people? I suppose the assumption is they're either in the prison system or have been killed.
When I was young, growing in Syria, my uncle, who was in high school, also was forcefully disappeared, or actually was detained by the father of current president, Hafez al-Assad. And I remember my grandmothers going every week to the local authorities, the intelligence authorities, trying to find some information about him. And every week she comes back humiliated and not knowing what's going on with him. He stayed in the Palmyra prison for 12 years, and then suddenly he appeared. So many of the family members do not know any information about their loved ones. They go from place to place. They contact human rights organizations, different ones. So this new entity hopefully will allow more coordinations between the different human rights organizations that collect information about the families and the victims. It should have representations of the victims, the survivors of torture, and also the families, so their voice can be heard. And so that way you have one stop for everyone who lost someone, who has someone disappeared in the prisons of Assad, and also other entities who are in Syria. You have also oppositions groups and the SDF who also detained and forcefully disappeared other victims.
Could you talk about, you've gone to Syria multiple times to assist in providing medical assistance. You were there just earlier this year after the earthquake. Could you describe the conditions in Syria now? Reportedly, 90%, up to 90% of Syrians are now living in poverty.
It's devastating. It's painful for me because I grew up in Syria and then came to the United States and practicing a physician. Every time I go there, I see the deterioration of the condition and the level of disparity and also the number of displaced people. I was inside Idlib, northwest of Syria, providing some training on new technology that helps physicians to treat trauma patients. But I was in the middle of large IDP camps camp that has 500,000 people. Everywhere you see around, you see tents. There is 1.5 million people who live in tents in Idlib. Half of the population, 4 million that you've mentioned in your report, are displaced from cities like Homs and Damascus and Aleppo. And they cannot imagine going back to their cities with the Assad regime still in control. And the economic situation is horrible. The children are everywhere. You look in the camp, but there is no enough schooling. Education is one of the most hit sectors in the economy there, and many parts of Syria. Also, healthcare is one of the worst hit. According to the WHO, half of the hospitals have been attacked by the Assad regime and by Russia. You mentioned in your previous piece about the Russian attacks on Chechnya. We believe in Syria that because what happens in Syria, you have now the war in Ukraine. There is a direct link between what happened in Syria, where the Russians used illegal weapons, they trained their army, they used, according to them, 300 new weapons in Syria. They targeted hospitals and civilian buildings like what they did today in Lviv, and now they're doing it in Ukraine because the war did not pay attention to what they were doing in Syria.
We're turning now to a new investigation by the BBC that reveals direct links between Syria's trade and the highly addictive amphetamine drug called Captagon and members of the armed forces and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's family.
My search reveals the role of Syria's most powerful family.
No smuggler operates without connections to the regime.
And I uncover how the Syrian regime itself has become addicted to Captagon.
If Assad stopped the drug trade for 20 days, the economy would collapse.
That's the opening of the new BBC documentary Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. The reporter narrating the piece is Rasha Kandil, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a presenter for BBC Arabic. She's going to join us in a minute from Cairo. But first, another clip where she speaks with a Syrian soldier who reveals his role in the Captagon trade. The soldier's identity is hidden for their safety.
Here in government-controlled Aleppo, we hope to find further evidence of the regime's role. We had to film secretly. This is the rarely seen interior of an army barracks. It's in a strikingly dilapidated state. We find a soldier willing to speak to us if we hide his identity. He tells us his monthly pay is only about 150,000 Syrian lira.
150,000 lira is equivalent to about $25 or $30. Barely enough for someone supporting two or three kids. So we became dealers selling to people. It's what brings in most of the money now.
We ask him to describe his unit's role in the local Captagon trade.
In 2021, I went out in a convoy with my comrades. We weren't allowed to go to the factory. They'd pick a meeting place and we'd buy from Hezbollah. The bags would contain 1 or 4 or 5 kilos. They'd decide how to fill them. We'd receive the goods, cover them, and leave. We coordinated with the 4th Division. The leaders would coordinate. The 4th Division's task was to facilitate our movement. If there was a traffic jam, they'd clear it. Stop the traffic so our convoy could move.
Once again, the Syrian army's elite 4th Division is named. Sutu is Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia political party and militant group. They're close to the Syrian government and have themselves been accused of involvement in drug trafficking.
The primary people responsible for manufacturing Captagon pills are Bashar al-Assad and his brother Maher al-Assad in association with Lebanese Hezbollah. The money goes straight into their pockets.
That's a clip from the new BBC documentary Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. For more, we're joined by Rasha Kandil. Welcome to Democracy Now! This is a powerful documentary. Captagon may be a new word for people outside of the region. It's been described as the poor man's cocaine. Can you tell us about it and how it came to be so prevalent, the production in Syria, but then especially its use in Saudi Arabia?
Thank you very much for having me. This is a sophisticated project by the BBC Arabic News Investigations team and the OCCRP. Being the lead reporter of the BBC team on this, we've been following in six countries for a year and a half the network, the web. We've been building this using witnesses, using unseen evidence, WhatsApp conversations, inside testimonies, a lot of leads. So it is called that because it's actually not very new, but it's new as a substance in the Middle East. Originally, it's an amphetamine-like substance, and it has been developed by Germany in the First and Second World War. But the formula being used now is very, very different. So it only carries the trade name of Captagon. We've come to the conclusion after a year and a half of work in six countries, France, Germany, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and the United Kingdom, there are direct links between members of the 4th Division and members of the Assad's family to the trade in the region, which is, as you probably know more than I am, it's flared. Very important project in terms of the capacity of CRP.
We're talking to Rasha Kandil. She is a presenter with BBC Arabic. Talking about this drug, Captagon, if you can explain, Rasha, how it's determining the geopolitics of the region and the acceptance of the Bashar al-Assad regime, inviting them back into the Arab community and possibly leading to the lifting of sanctions.
Thank you very much for the excellent question. It's actually a force of pressure, not only in the region, but also on an international level. And as for the EU and the United States are concerned, that clearly shows, and this is what I indicated, and my team, the brilliant director and all the rest of the team, indicate that the sanctions on the Syrian and Lebanese people is not actually the impact that was targeted by the United States and recently by the United Kingdom. It is a force in the region, in the Middle East, and as you know, there is a new renormalization with Bashar al-Assad in Arab League recently. And from insider information from the Arab League, I've heard many times throughout filming this investigation that it was actually the main card on the table. And I've been told by prominent sources that Bashar al-Assad was asked directly to control the Captagon in the region in return of Syria coming back to the Arab League. So definitely in the coming few months, this is going to be a main factor in a lot of changes in the Middle East, probably in the dynamics as well between Russia and the United States, given the heat happening in Ukraine. And also the trade itself is very, very powerful. The networks are universal now. And the alternative routes that are developed by smugglers every single day are reaching out fast and furious to Europe. And nobody knows yet if it's reaching the United States or not, but nothing is impossible in such trade. Five pills are being produced every year and consumed by the Gulf. You've pointed to a very important thing, which is why Saudi Arabia is the biggest consumer in this. I've also heard, even though that we haven't really had much interaction with Saudi Arabia, they were not very involved in the film, but I've heard from prominent sources in the Gulf that they consider this to be a war by Bashar al-Assad on them as a return back to the war on Syria since 2012. So it's definitely a geopolitical issue that needs to be looked into.
And Rasha, just before we end, if you could tell us who are the principal consumers, who are the people who are addicted to Captagon in Syria, but also in Saudi Arabia and other places?
I've heard horrific stories over a year and a half about young people, minors under 15, who consume this heavily in all the countries that I've visited, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, and at the Gulf. And I've heard other stories from prominent officials in the Middle East that some of them are being abused to be used as smugglers. So they are forced to become addicts, and then they are used on the borders to become smugglers because they cost almost nothing in return to the profit that goes back to those who are making use of this trade. So I'm really sorry to say that it's mostly young people. Some of them are targeted on purpose. But also there are, like, we've interviewed in the film a user, and he's under 22 years of old, and he's been an addict for 6 years. The atrocities he's been subjected to and told us are untold. It's really sad to see a new generation relying on such substance and just not being able to get out of it.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're having trouble with the Skype connection. Rasha Kandila, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Fellow, Center for International Policy, presenter for BBC Arabic. You can see the new documentary, Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire, on YouTube. And Dr. Zahar Salul, President and CEO of Med Global. And back in 30 seconds with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Stay with us. To remain, to return, by Aruj Aftab. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we spend the rest of the hour with Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, who has several topics to discuss with us. Congressmember, thanks so much for being with us. Joining us, though, you represent California from Charleston, South Carolina. We want to start with your introduction of a bill to limit Supreme Court justices to 18-year terms. What are you calling for?
Amy, most Americans have seen that the Supreme Court is just wildly out of touch with the facts of modern life. They're taking away rights from women. They are penalizing students who are poorer. They are making campuses less diverse. They're rolling back environmental legislation. So what we are saying is, let's have term limits on these justices. Every president gets two appointments. The justices get 18 years. And then they can go serve on a lower court, so they remain a judge for life under the Constitution.
And what about the number of Supreme Court justices one president can choose? I've heard the number two. You know, Trump chose three, of course.
Exactly. Every president would get two appointments. And so this would prevent something like the Merrick Garland situation, which is cast such illegitimacy on the court, where Mitch McConnell just blocked President Obama from picking someone and then expedited the process for Trump to get three appointments. Now every president would get an appointment, two appointments in their four-year term.
And Congressmember, can you also talk about being the sole person, I think it was 58-1, on the House Armed Services Committee to vote no on the new Pentagon budget?
Well, Amy, it's not a distinction that I want. I wish more of my colleagues would recognize what is so obvious to many Americans, that you have a bloated Pentagon budget. Defense contractors are making extraordinary profits, having goods sold to the American public at 10,000% inflation. And we need to tackle that. So the money is not just going to troops. It's not just going to national security. It's lining the pockets of many of these defense executives. And we're approaching almost a $1 trillion defense budget. It's nearly 56% of discretionary income. I'd rather that we be investing some of that money in our schools here at home, in creating good jobs here at home, in helping the working class.
I also wanted to ask you about the visit of Prime Minister Modi. President Biden welcomed the Indian Prime Minister to the White House, praising a new era in U.S.-India relations, the trip roundly condemned by human rights advocates. At least five Democratic lawmakers announced plans to boycott Modi's joint address to Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman. In a post on social media, Congressmember Tlaib wrote, "It's shameful that Modi's been given a platform at our nation's capital. His long history of human rights abuses, anti-democratic actions targeting Muslims and religious minorities, and censoring journalists is unacceptable," she said. More than 70 Democrats in the House and Senate also signed a letter urging Biden to focus on human rights in talks with Modi. Congressmember Khanna, many in the progressive community were surprised to learn you were not only in favor of Modi addressing a joint session of Congress and Biden welcoming Modi with a rare state dinner, one of the highest diplomatic honors bestowed on a foreign leader, but you were a major engine for this. Amit Srivastava wrote in Truthout, "Why did Rep. Khanna, who positions himself as a progressive, choose to invite Modi in spite of the prime minister and the BJP's track record of violence and bigotry, especially at a moment when the Uttarakhand and Manipur violence are escalating? The answer lies in the U.S.-India defense partnership and the drive toward war. It's clear that in the context of a growing Cold War with China and Russia, the West has decided it's time to withdraw India in, even if it means playing to the megalomania of an authoritarian leader." Your response, Congressmember Khanna?
Well, it's a fair question. I believe that the prime minister is an elected leader of 1.4 billion people, and the way to make progress on human rights is to engage with the Indian prime minister. I also am sensitive that India is two generations removed from colonialism. My grandfather, as you know, spent years in jail under British colonialism and then was part of the Congress Party advocating for pluralism. So the idea that India is going to respond simply by being lectured from the West is not going to work. And my view is similar to Fareed Zakaria's or President Obama's, that we have to engage India, a rising democracy, an ally, though they have problems, and then have a conversation about the challenge of multiracial, multiethnic democracy. And that means respecting minority rights. It means making sure that Sikhs, Muslims, Christians all are treated equally and having those candid conversations with the prime minister and others, as I did when I had the opportunity to meet the prime minister. But to simply boycott a country that has chosen to elect their own a leader, I think, would be a mistake and not actually advance human rights in India.
According to The Nation, you received more than $110,000 from Hindu nationalist figures in the United States. Your response?
Well, we raise millions of dollars online. There are many Indian Americans who contribute to our campaign, many Pakistani Americans who contribute to our campaign. I don't ask their view on Indian politics when they're contributing, but certainly I have gone out of my way to criticize right-wing nationalism in India, to stand up for pluralism, and even have, in the last two election cycles, had a challenger who has been supported by some of the extreme elements because they didn't like my stance on pluralism.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Congressmember Ro Khanna, Democratic Congressmember from California, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, just recently voted no on the Pentagon budget, the sole voice in the Armed Service Committee. The vote was 58-1, that vote from Ro Khanna. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagarik, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see our interviews and video and audio podcasts, you can go to democracynow.org and sign up there for our daily news digest. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.